And we're live. Dave, it is fantastic to see you. Oh, you were making such a nice face for the letter.
No, I really wasn't.
I should have
used more like
that
a sort of
thumbnail.
Jazz hand.
We always need like you know, shocked YouTuber face or like...
Yes.
For the stupid thumbnail, which you did the last time. Usually I do it, but somehow my Affinity Designer app just like won't save anything. It would literally just hang for an hour when I try to save files, which is kind of weird.
Damn it.
I thought it was saving in iCloud, but it's not in iCloud. It's just on the disk. And I thought it would be fixed with a reboot, but it isn't. So I'm going to have to troubleshoot at some point. But
I have a suggestion.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
What's the suggestion?
Buy Pixelmator Pro, and I will send you over my template from last week.
The template is like fine. Like mine is also just like 3 minutes of work, right? But I kind of like Affinity. I was a Pixelmator user for a long, long time, but I assume I don't have the Pro because that's probably a like I bought Pixelmator at some point when the App Store came out for the Mac, so I assume I have Pixelmator but not Pro.
Yeah, that's likely.
Yeah, Pro says gives me a buy icon, and I can't find a non-Pro. Hang on, I'm gonna go.
Yeah.
Other apps by this developer is nothing, basically. Okay. So the Pixelmator non-pro is not even a thing anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to try it one more time tomorrow. And then if it's not working, then I guess I'll reinstall or something. And then if that doesn't work, then yeah, it's probably time to buy Pixelmator Pro because I'm a pro at the podcast.
Indeed.
But I want to introduce the podcast before you poke me to do it. So
go
hey,
for it, Daniel. Hit it.
Welcome to Waiting for Review, a show about the majestic indie developer lifestyle. Join our scintillating hosts, Dave and Daniel, that's me, and let's hear about the tiny slice of their thrilling lives. Join us while waiting for review. Getting ever closer to the microphone because it's just so majestic and everything.
Oh, how are you, Daniel? How are things been?
Oh, my life is thrilling as always.
Scintillating.
So I'm going to work backwards because today and yesterday, I basically spent all my time in server land, which I'm not a native of. And I don't really feel welcome there. I'm just doing my best. Like I'm learning the language. I'm trying to do all the right things. But still, server stuff is just massively frustrating to me. And on the other hand, though, it is really important and necessary. And it's getting more and more because we're getting more and more customers, which is really nice. Thank you, awesome customers. And they're sending more and more data, which is also very nice. Thank you, awesome customers. But that data needs to be massaged and stored and sent around to various services and then queried and like prepared and defragmented. Every time we need a new order of magnitude, like there's just a different set of problems that I was like, oh yeah, like every time I solve the problems and then I'm like, oh yeah, now we're ready for the next year or so. And then we hit another order of magnitude. And then it's like all the same again. So we actually, a few days ago, we hit 4 billion signals, which is pretty cool.
What?
And
I remember when it was 2 billion. That doesn't feel that long ago.
Yeah, it's speeding up. And it turns out 4 billion is way harder to manage than 4 billion, than 2 billion somehow. And it amounts to about a terabyte a month right now of data.
Right. Wow.
It's a lot of like stuff just.
Yeah.
And the problem is that, I don't know, like the data is moving from point A to point B. Like it produces so much bandwidth that like bandwidth costs are going up. Then it needs to be like managed and queried and like stored and defragged and whatever in the Apache Druid cluster, which is our database. And that's mostly where I've been spending my time. And it's just so hard to get that thing to be really, really high performance. Mm-hmm. And that is, that has like multiple reasons. Like one of the reasons is, which was really frustrating to me, and I'm going into the weeds now. I'm
going
to really
keep going into the weeds. Oh. I want to know.
So listener, if you don't care about Java on the server doing weird Java things that no one likes, you can just skip this podcast. Just like, I don't know. Like, rate us on iTunes. Thanks for listening. Rate us on iTunes. Rate us on YouTube. Send us emails at contact@waitingforreview. And where can people find you, Dave?
Oh my God, Daniel, don't. Yeah, keep going. Don't skip to the end. Let's hear more.
So the thing that annoys me the most is the overhead. Like we are paying for our servers, we've been granted a very gracious startup credit thing by Microsoft for hosting on Azure, and that's going to run out. So now we're going to actually have to pay for our computing power, and so I'm optimizing for that, but also optimizing just for the new amount of data that we're now managing, and it's so frustrating because we are hosting on Kubernetes because that's the easiest to manage, right? Initiative. Like I was going to say, like, don't write email, but like we're not getting so much email. So whatever, if you disagree, write us an email, write us a toot. but yeah, so I'm using Kubernetes because that's the easiest to manage for me. And because there's so many different things and I can use various shortcuts to make my life easier.
Yeah.
Kubernetes does this thing where you can't have swap space, basically. So if your thing uses too much RAM, it will just be mercilessly killed. You will just like 4-5 seconds you used more than your allotted amount of RAM. Like, we're gonna kill you. Wow. And the allotted amount of RAM is a bit arbitrary. So what happens is that you can have, of course, multiple containers on one like machine, right? Because it's Docker. And so one thing that will just evict containers is if the whole machine says like, okay, my total amount of RAM is almost getting full, so I need to throw something out. So that will kill your process. But also you can have a thing where you request a certain amount of RAM to be reserved for you. And if you do that, for example, to prevent too many containers being scheduled on the same machine, if you do that, then also if you go above that, you can go up about like say, let's say 10% above that. But if you go more than 10% or more than a few minutes, then you will be mercilessly killed. And so I'm trying, and then I'm going to finish this thought first, and then I'm going to have the other. And so on top of that, so what you do is kind of you leave like 10-20% of space just at the top there. You configure everything headroom to never use the full amount of RAM that you actually have, that you're paying for, right?
You sit under your limit.
You're paying for 128 gigs of RAM, and then you use 110 maybe, or you allocate 110. But then there's another thing, which is Apache Druid is written in Java. And Java does this super weird thing where if you launch a Java application on the server, at least, I think it's on the desktop as well. If you launch a Java application, you kind of have to supply it with the amount of RAM it's allowed to use.
Okay.
And if it hits or exceeds that, it will crash with an out of memory exception. So there's another ceiling where if you hit that, it will crash. So on top of the Kubernetes ceiling, you will like where you actually have to stay underneath, there's another ceiling where I'm like, okay, I'm going to have some safety margin to that ceiling as well.
Mm-hmm.
So out of the 110 gigabytes of RAM, I'm maybe daring to go to 100, but today after a few tests, like, I'm actually going down to 90 because it will spike and then it will hit the thing and then will either be killed by Java or by Kubernetes.
Wow.
And this is just the way it is. Like for the people who mainly use Kubernetes, like a bit of RAM
is part of the job.
Not so much. Like, but I feel like there's a machine and I really want to use its performance.
Yeah.
especially since now I can't use the CPU or CPU cores in that machine anymore because I'm reducing my own amount of tasks that I'm doing. So I was like, cool. Now the CPU is like only half saturated as well. And before you say like, oh, but you shouldn't saturate your servers fully, that's correct. But this kind of server is a worker server that will get a task every now and then has to work on that task as quickly as possible because yep. I want it to be done as much as quickly as possible. If it gets killed, it's not that bad. The system can retry the tasks and rebuild the server for that. But yeah, it's not something that will continuously run at full tilt.
I understand. It's got a response, sort of like a burst pressure of stuff right. that it then relieves. But Daniel, I've got a very key question inside of all of this.
Okay.
I thought telemetry deck stack was in Vapor, and you're mentioning Java.
Right. So the code that I wrote is written in Swift and Vapor, so that's correct. Although there's a tiny bit of Python in there.
Mm-hmm. We forgive you, Daniel. It's okay.
But our database, our time series database cluster is Apache Druid, and that is written in Java. And so that's not something that I wrote, but that's still still the main the main source of administrative work because that is the database that contains all our data. And it's actually really good. Like it sounds like I hate it, and okay, sometimes I do hate it, but it's still. I think it's the best tool for the job. It's really well thought out. It's well supported. It's well. It's getting continuous upgrades, and the development is actually moving places. And yeah, so nothing against that, but it is written in Java and has the problems that it has, and it's also written by people who want to build something that is highly configurable. Up to a point where I'm like, come on, please just do it. Like pick a default or, you know, like just infer the size of the merge buffers from the amount of RAM or something. Like don't make me do that myself and then say on the website, oh yeah, this should actually be the number of processes times the amount of whatever. I'm like, yeah but if you have that calculation on the website, come do it yourself, please. Sometimes if you leave out the value, it actually will do it itself, but it's kind of a trial and error process when it does that.
That doesn't sound fun. None of that sounds like fun to my Swift-addled, Xcode-addled brain.
I mean, yeah, but it's also kind of a server admin thing. Like I've been writing server code for half my life, I think, and it's just something that you have to deal with. Like every time I actually switch from mobile development to server development or the other way around, especially before when I did only one thing for one gig and then the other thing for the next gig, every time you switch, you kind of have to switch to change gears in your brain. Because on a mobile phone or a mobile device or on the desktop even, what you really want to do is save or have performance that feels immediate. Like you're going to do a thing once and it has to be quick the first time, but it doesn't have to be perfect or it doesn't have to be, I don't know, like login or whatever complexity. Whereas on the server, you're going to do things a million times. It can take 5 minutes to start. It can take a long time, but if you repeat it a million times, it needs to be efficient.
Yeah.
And I think that's also actually a pretty thing to really keep in mind when writing different software for the different platforms. The other thing, though, is you're completely right. Like it's hard to find out those things, especially because it's hard to sometimes prototype these things. Like with an app or even with my API server, I can just start it or run the unit tests or whatever. But to find out like what's the correct setting for the buffers or whatever, I have to have a thing where I have to have a cluster with all my data in it. And so, and also that's kind of expensive to host, right? So I don't want to have a duplicate cluster hanging around, but I bit the bullet and I have a tiny second cluster, which is actually kind of fun because when I started, the config file that actually brings up the whole thing was called Tiny Telemetry Deck Cluster because I was just like, yeah, this is from the example file that's called small cluster, and I renamed it to tiny because I was like, okay, this is very small.
It's sort of alliterative with telemetry deck there as well.
I have a second cluster now, and I have actually right now as we are speaking, I am ingesting into it all the data from January and February.
Mm-hmm.
And my day so far, my entire day was just like, okay, like provisioning that cluster, like just bringing it up and then making Azure, like asking Azure to, oh, can I have some more CPU cores, please? Yes, I know my quota has exceeded, but like I need some more cores. Like, I mean, I have like so many credits that's going to go, that are going to go unused in April. So can I please have some cores? That's how they get you. They give you all these free credits and then you can't use them. I basically started a task that says, okay, load all the data for January. Failed at some point because of the memory limitations, because like I actually used it as like I managed to get a day or two in, and then I deleted that again and was like, okay, now I'm gonna get the whole thing. But fine tune my performance settings, because I can't do that on the live cluster, because every time I change something, of course, at least the server types, this thing has like five different server types, and they're called Overlord and Peon. It's kind of also all kind of a Warcraft thing going on there. The middle managers was what I was working on. So every time I change the configuration, I need to restart all the middle managers, which the Kubernetes thing does for me. But so of course all the tasks are gone, and then like I can't do that on the live cluster. It causes chaos, and also people's queries will sometimes not work and whatever. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this on the secondary cluster, and then just try out all these things that I can't normally try out. And that's basically what I've been doing all day. And I've just looked, and I'm seeing a wall of about 1,387 green lights. I'm going to send you a screenshot. Or I post it later, and then I can actually reference it.
Post it and reference it. It's all good. Yeah.
And that is good, because then this process actually worked, and that is good because my tuning is now in a place where this thing is highly, or at least the middle managers are very performant, and also don't crash because they touch any of the ceilings, basically, which is also very good. So the next step is now to use that cluster that actually has data to then also fine tune the things with the, you know, to also fine tune the data queries and stuff like that. Queries, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah.
Wow. With all of this, it sounds like it's a case of like, having the secondary boxes been a good idea, right?
The secondary box, he says. The 16 secondary boxes, you mean?
I understand. Yeah. It's a cluster.
Eight of which are like high performance, 32 cores, 128 gigs of RAM kind of machines.
But besides that, it's just a box. It's a secondary box. I mean,
it is just a box. You are correct.
Sorry, but I don't mean to besmirch the many box and boxes. So that's been a good idea. Staying under your limits for each layer also has got to be a good idea.
So the three things that this thing has to do regularly is ingestion. That's what I've been optimizing now.
Yep.
Then, of course, queries, which is a different type of server. It's called a historical. And that basically gets the queries that you send to telemetry deck. And then like one of the coordinators, I think, will kind of chop up the query into different like segments, which are from day to day. Like, for example, if you have the querying a range from January and February, then you have like four historical servers, then like one will get the first 2 weeks of January, one will get the second week of January, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then they will actually run the queries, and they need a lot of disk space. They need a lot of RAM. They need a lot of CPU. So next up is, now that I have example data, is actually optimizing those. And then the third task that this thing really needs to do is compaction, which is basically data defragmentation. The older people among us will remember as kids, like staring at their computer screens while their hard drive was defragged by, Norton something, or Windows defrag or whatever.
Yep. Wow. And that takes me back.
Yeah. And basically that process, because that will tremendously improve performance in Apache Druid queries, because it can pre-sort the data. Like, for example, you can pre-sort the data by app ID, test mode, and then a few more properties that are basically in every signal. And so if you basically filtering for these with every query. So if you can pre-sort those, then the server won't have to actually look at a lot of the data that is in there, and will have we'll just look at your app, for example, and just with the test mode equals false, stuff like that.
Couple of things that are springing to my mind with this is, like, when you say pre-sort, does that mean it's literally sorting stuff on disk somewhere, or is it building up indexes of things to say, well, okay, if I sort this by this, then that's where the things live?
Both, kind of. So what is actually happening is, like, the Druid format is a binary format, and it's very much index based, but it does it has these keys, and they are kind of hashes. And I'm telling it, all right, your hash consists of, like, whatever you decide, plus app ID, plus test mode, let's say, and then also sort by that hash. And what that means, because it knows that all the properties I gave it are in there, it actually, whenever I filter by app ID, it will actually can go to exactly that place in the file. And that's the other thing, because these are called segment files. And when I just pour in the data, a day will result in about, I don't know, 1,000 files on disk, which will have, let's say, 100,000 or 500,000 or so, like, signals in them each.
Yeah.
Don't check those numbers. Like, these are just off the top, like, just example numbers. But that is actually not very performative, because good for performance, because what you really want is, like, you want to have as little files as possible. You want to have about 7 million entries per file.
Yeah.
And so instead, like, the process will have to look into all these files, then all get the data out there that is relevant, keep it all in RAM, and then actually, like, once it has collected all the data, then it can actually start. Whereas if it's just a few files, and then maybe even all your data is in one file, then it can just, like, look at that file and then start work there. This is all very, very low level, of course.
Yeah.
Start work there and then go on there. And so, yeah. And because one historical can hold hundreds of gigabytes of data, it can't fit all into RAM. So that's also a reason why these need, like, reasonably fast hard disks.
Yep. Damn.
Yeah.
Big insight into the telemetry deck cluster, which is huge. I'm sorry, Daniel, I have to highlight this. I remember talking with you probably, 2 years ago when I was interviewing people in season two. And there was a conversation I remember we had a little while ago where you were sort of saying, just run it on the one server and just keep feeding it as much capacity as it needs until you outgrow it. Then I remember you taking everything to a clustered stack, and it sounds like it's exactly the journey you've been describing just earlier, which is that at each stage, it's like a different level of both a different level of complexity and a different level of abstraction that sort of kicks in almost.
Oh yeah,
as well.
Very, very much so. Like at every stage, I need to, on the one hand, go deeper into the abstraction and, like, go more into the details of stuff that was kind of papered over by the previous layer of abstraction, because I need to optimize the buffers and whatever, the segments and but at the same time also zoom out and look at a bigger picture and try to automate even more, try to, like, organize. I'm not organizing individual servers. I'm organizing whole Kubernetes clusters, basically.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. But yeah, that's kind of the deal, where you wanna be very careful to not prematurely optimize, but also you wanna be very you want to recognize when is the time to be like, okay, this paradigm doesn't work anymore and it needs a rework. It probably doesn't need a rewrite or recreation, but it needs some kind of work to actually prepare it or bring it into the next year, basically.
And, what drives that for you? What drives that moment?
Usually it's a feeling of technical debt building up.
Yeah.
Like right now with the existing cluster, I'm like, okay, stuff is working mostly, but compaction tasks are failing about half the time. So performance has been degraded, which is super annoying to me. Every other day or so, will send me a message saying like, hey, somehow I can't connect to my database. Oh, wait, I can't. Like this thing has a Postgres database to know where all its segments are, basically. Yep. And then it's like, oh, okay, now I'm back because the database is actually super, like it has disk space still, but that Postgres database is actually using 100% CPU in its container. So actually I gave this a bit. So these are all symptoms. Like every now and then, like something will slightly break. Like a few days ago, we had an incident where one of those services kind of stopped and nothing was really, and so like I actually saw in the next morning that it hadn't, like the live streaming of data into the server had kind of stopped. So I kind of restarted that and nothing was actually lost. Like all the data all kind of came back, but it took the whole day or even more than a day to actually go back to real time, like to catch up basically to real time, which was too long for my taste. So the short answer is I kind of feel it, but the long answer is there's a few indications. Like you want to find the thing, the abstraction level that feels comfortable right now, where you feel like with your current resources you can maintain it, and where it's not like a huge it doesn't feel like an adventure, like because an adventure is always something we want to go on, right? We want to explore, we want to try out new things, and most of the time, like, don't do that with your infrastructure or with your database or stuff like that.
These things should be boring almost after a point, right?
It's like your current state feels more and more like, oh, I'm fighting against this. This is a chore that is like actively unfun right now.
Yeah.
Then it's probably time to think about, okay, what is the next step that restores the boring state?
That makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. And it kind of reminds me of when we talked a few shows back about the idea of sort of pain-driven development, right?
It's like when I you think feel that's that the pain. Same philosophy. There's a conference talk in there somewhere. Whenever sure I can find is. The time to actually write it and find a conference that will have me.
PDD.
PDD, yeah. That's definitely the kind of the same. And then you also you can have adventures, but on your front end, in your user interface, or on the thing that you're actually innovating on, like for example, with your awesome video pipeline, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you want to be innovative.
This is actually reminding me of that a little bit. So I'm just one of the reasons we've spoken more about your server-side stuff this show is because I've kind of parked myself recently in terms of the development I've been doing. I hit a bit of a wall last weekend and then I've not been feeling too good this week, so I've taken a bunch of time out. There's actually an issue over there with the pipeline. There is an adventure for me to go on, a quest for me to pick up when I'm feeling a bit better. Right now I've got mental background processes, as it were, probably thinking about the issues still that will, you know, hopefully come good when I next sit down and look at it. Yeah. But
sometimes you need to step away.
Yeah. But what I'm thinking about with that pipeline is that, it's been a similar thing, different levels of complexity, different levels of challenge. And you're right, there is a part of me that definitely needs it to reach a boring stage, a known state, just to highlight what it's been over there for me is I built out this node-based video pipeline about 4 or 5 months ago, started working on it, and brought it to a stage of a test app, and I can link the nodes together and make different effects with this. I fast forward to the last month or so, and I've now been bringing that into my video mixing app and wiring it up to the UI. I'm actually really glad I've done it this way. So I had a whole moment a few weeks ago where I was sort of saying how I felt bad that I'd not been working on the pro version of the app that this pipeline is going to support. Hmm. One of the reasons that I currently have this sort of side quest to go back to of optimization and issue within it is because of that work, right? So I'm now, because I'm wiring it up, I'm now able to feel the bits that didn't work with lower complexity a few months ago, and now literally adding it back into the app that I've got that has a lot more going on, I'm now hitting that complexity. Mm-hmm. And that is causing me this immediate pain. When everything comes off and works, you won't know it. Like the app will just work. It will just do what it's supposed to do. Right now, I've once again made a very good thermal heater for your hand. which fantastic. Is something you won't get in serverland unless you've literally got your cluster on your desk and your hand underneath it, right? It's like, if I get something wrong with mine, people's devices get very hot because in this case it's somewhere to do with how it's passing one layer to the other, and I'm pretty sure there's a loop somewhere in there, but anyway, I will rejoin my side quest to try and fix the pipeline, to try and get this sorted at some point in the next, probably at the weekend coming up, actually.
Awesome. Good luck. Like, I hope it will, like, your rejoin will be swift and fantastic. But yeah,
the payoff will be worth it.
Whatever you're developing, and regardless of your size, you want to reach a place of safety and boredom every now and a while. Where it's like, okay, like, I am on a very good or reasonably good foundation. Yeah. And I can be creative on top of that foundation.
That's it entirely. And I think, again, I'm relating this very immediately back to my current issue, right? I don't have unit tests at the moment across this video pipeline, right? Quite deliberately so, because there's been a whole element of, like, it's been very just needing to be built very quickly to do what it does. And I've been able to sort of hold the whole lay of the land in my head. Mm-hmm. The last weekend kind of proved to me I currently can't hold the lay of the land entirely in my head all at once now. It's kind of outgrown that. And again, that's something else that is sort of a tiered complexity, right? When you're just noodling about with something, it's probably the wrong time to strap loads of tests around it. Mm-hmm. Now it's being attached to a real app and it's got some real constraints and things it needs to do, and now I'm hitting these sort of things. I'm probably going to have to put some sort of automated test harness around this.
Then the correct time to do it, like, because while you're still sketching, like, putting a test scaffolding around something that's still, like, being formed in your brain is, like, ridiculous.
Yes, it's counterproductive. I think that will probably, if I can predict a future show's content, Daniel, I think there's probably going to be a story a few weeks out from now of me adding some sort of test harness around stuff. Nice. There.
Very good.
Yeah. But
I have some feedback to our last show, by the way. Oh. Because what I do these days is already, I slice up the show and find some interesting tidbits.
Yeah.
Slightly automated, but not fully. And like, post those on Reels and YouTube Shorts and TikTok. Which, mm-hmm. Hi, if you're watching this on TikTok. I don't know if this will land on TikTok. But then, of course, I go on TikTok with my own account and just, like, mindlessly scroll, as I want to do, mm-hmm. which is actually why I set I set myself a time restriction. Like, my phone will actually, like, lock the TikTok app after an hour. and sometimes I actually run into that, and then I'm like, yeah, okay, fine.
Yep.
But I kind of scroll past and I see a post from both of us, because like I switched the account back to my account, and then of course I follow the Waiting for Review account and I see us both. And you were talking about killing your view models.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know if you know this, but on TikTok, you'd never say killing. You never say killing. I think it's to escape a imagined or real censorship. I'm not 100% sure.
Oh, did our account get dinged?
No, but what sometimes happens, or like what people sometimes talk about, is that accounts will get shadow banned. I don't know if that actually happens or not, or if that only happens for large accounts and we are not yet large or whatever. Anyway, the correct term for TikTok is you unalived your view models. You unalived them.
okay. Yeah, so...
So please unalive your view models. Also unalive your idols.
Mm-hmm. And... unalive your previous system constraints. So I'm trying to bring it back to the server topic we started with.
So that's the one feedback that like the one thing that I actually had that was a throwback to a previous show. And the other one, this is not turning into ATP, but I have follow up, is over the last few shows, we sometimes talked about the European DMA Digital Markets Act that heavily influenced iOS 17.4 that is coming out these days.
Yes.
And one topic that we had was that PWAs, web apps on your home screen, would be thrown out, would no longer be allowed. And that has been reverted. Unalived, yes. PWAs have been unalived. And that has been reverted, so PWAs have been unalived.
Okay.
And so if you are in the European Union and update to 17.4, your web apps should be fine. I haven't tried it yet. Good. I think I'm still on 17.3. But, yeah. Damn. It should be fine.
I'm glad, because... yeah, I use PDAs, PWAs even, can't even say them. Yeah, but no, I use PWAs all the time. I've got Feedback Bulb, which is our friend Constantine's product, friend and listener of the show. Yeah, and so I use Feedback Bulb for collecting feedback from my apps, and the web interface of that is really lovely, and he set it all up so you can use it as a PWA. And so I have that on my home screen.
You need a better word for that.
I know.
Like PWA. It's like too many syllables for a acronym.
Yep.
Because of the stupid way that English speakers pronounce W. And also, like, I don't know, like, can we just say PWA?
PWA? Yeah. Or PWA.
PWA. Oh, PWA is even better. PWA.
Yep.
Like, my favorite abbreviation is, I think, the WSGI server.
Yeah.
Which is pronounced whiskey.
Whiskey, okay. Yeah.
So PWA is, yeah, that's just right PWA. right in that direction. Fantastic.
But yeah, I use PWAs all the time, and I would be very annoyed to not have that and to have to then go to my browser for that, just because it's muscle memory.
Maybe not to
now.
Turn that into the Apple bashing podcast of the week, but yeah, I mean, especially because sometimes it's hard and frustrating to get things into the App Store, having that escape hatch of PWAs is just really helpful.
And it actually serves Apple to have that escape hatch as well, right? It's like, yeah, well, you know, you've always got that route. It's I'm surprised. I was actually pretty surprised when they went that direction. It definitely felt like malicious compliance to me at that point. And I'm glad they're backpedaling, because I think that could have become, you know, a much bigger issue than it needed to be. And yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to get into Apple bashing right now, Daniel. I feel like I would like to see them making more positive decisions around all of this, rather than trying to sort of thread the needle on not doing what they're being asked to do. You know, like, I'd rather we weren't talking about backtracking on PWAs.
And it's kind of sad, because Apple is doing so many cool things. Like, I know many people who work at Apple and like friends and acquaintances who are really awesome and amazing. And like, whenever I do some nice little Apple bashing, that's not, I don't mean those people. Like, I mean the people like super high up in charge who decide on these policies. And I mean, so of course, like, I love people who are at Apple, so don't.
Yeah, same.
Don't same. Feel attacked, please.
And yeah,
it, so it many ends talented up that... people with the right priorities and like who really want to be make awesome stuff, and that makes that delights people. And yeah, that's where we should go.
Yeah. But Daniel, on that note, yeah. I am going to have to get on with the rest of my day here on this side of the world.
I already read the outro. I don't know what you want me to do.
Go back, read it again. We've got to close this bit of the show. Come on.
Fantastic. Chop, chop. Right. I'm going back to my servers now. So yep. Thanks for listening. Please rate us on iTunes and YouTube. Please send us emails at contact@waitingforreview.com. Please write me toots at daniel@social.telemetrydeck.com. And where can people find you, Dave?
People can toot at me at dave@social.lightbeamapps.com. And you can find out all about my apps at lightbeamapps.com. And in fact, if you go to lightbeamapps.com/govjpro, you'll be able to see a sneak peek of what I will eventually be working on with this video pipeline.
It's pretty.
It is very pretty. All
right. See you soon, Dave. Bye.
Take it easy, Daniel.
Bye. Almost forgot the wave.